TNT Radio wants to know what you really think. Because your opinion matters. At TNTRadio.live, upload a video, some audio, or drop us a note on TNT Radio's Soapbox. Today's news talk, TNT Radio. Germ Warfare is Jeremy Nell on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Germ Warfare at TNTRadio.live is my email address. Thank you to everybody who has emailed me and will hopefully still email me. As always, let me know where in the world you are emailing me from. It's absolutely delightful to know that there are people listening everywhere, even in Russia. I had an email from somebody who was listening from Moscow. As you might know, I'm in South Africa, and there are currently Russian ships that have docked just not too far away from my home because I'm in Cape Town. Lots of security, can't really get there. But it's obviously sort of making world headlines. You know, why are there Russian, or at least maybe not world headlines, but certainly making national headlines, why are there Russian ships off the coast of South Africa? Well, obviously, we are part of BRICS. And South Africa is quite schizophrenic because on the one hand, we have a completely inept, useless, pathetic government that can't govern. And thankfully, it's a good thing because they are so useless that they haven't been able to lock us down effectively since 2020. You know, we have a population that just gives them the middle finger the whole time. And God bless them. But on the other hand, we also like our American imports and we like getting American technology. It's a very strange place, this, because when you're in Africa, you have no idea who to side with. You know, do you like the United States or the West, or do you not like the West? So we kind of have one foot everywhere. And at some point, I think it's going to hurt us. But for now, I'm not terribly worried about Russian ships off our coastline, particularly because Russia is so hated at the moment. Everybody thinks Russian man bad, you know. And if the West is going to completely censor RT and Sputnik and everything to do with Russia, I have a suspicion, therefore, that Russia might not be that bad. Jump into the live chat on TNT's website, tntradio.live. I've got it open in front of me. I think that's all my housekeeping. My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the Battle of Ideas.
Stream us wherever you are.
I listen on Alexa.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Ron Bombi, I hope I pronounced it correctly. Thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thank you for having me, Jeremy. It's good to be back on TNT Radio.
Well, it's a great pleasure having you. I am currently experiencing beautiful global warming here at the bottom tip of the African continent. It's a sunny day. The sky is blue. I think it's a wonderful thing to have warmer weather.
So, Jeremy, it's not a red light for humanity. The oceans aren't boiling and the crops aren't burning up. You're actually enjoying it, are you?
I'm loving it. You know what? I mean, people hate it when I say this because these days everybody gets offended, but I like seeing my wife wearing less clothing. I mean, in winter, she covers up, you know, so all hell warmer weather.
Yeah. Well, and the other benefit that may impact you or not is probably crop yields in the last 20 years are up 15 or 20% because of more CO2 in the air. And I heard Dr. Steve Koonin on a podcast just last week, and he thinks from the early 1980s, crop yields are up 40%. So not only are there more women running around in bikinis, but there's a lot more to eat on to feed us 8 billion people. So
that's a pretty good equation.
Global warming is not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that a little bit later, but before I jump into that, what is the CO2 Coalition?
The CO2 Coalition is a group currently of about 143 scientists, and is mostly centered in the United States, but they are from various countries. And what they promote is knowledge of CO2 and how it works. And if you could sum it up in one liner, I would say CO2 is good for you. CO2 is not a health concern. It does not cause runaway global warming. We are at levels of CO2 on the planet which are near plant starvation levels. CO2 in plants and photosynthesis don't know where the CO2 comes from. whether mankind put it there or whether it came from degassing the oceans, it doesn't matter. It's good for plants and it doesn't harm humans and it doesn't cause runaway global warming. So the question the CO2 Coalition puts forward is why are we counting all these negatives that probably don't exist and why don't we look at the positives? Maybe we should be putting more CO2 into the air.
I know a bunch of farmers and they use CO2 to in their greenhouses. I don't understand why this is seen as such a bad thing.
Well, if an average CO2 greenhouse is probably 1,000 parts per million CO2, maybe even 1,200. And the air you're breathing out right now, Jeremy, is probably 420. And when I was a kid, that's how old I am, it was much less. It was probably around 300. And there is no change to human beings. If you think about it, how much CO2 does a sailor working in a submarine breathe? Well, quite a bit. And so it doesn't harm human health till it gets to the levels way above what we can conceive. The other thing to think about is that in ancient climates, in paleo climates, we had up to 12 times the CO2 in the air that we have today, and the world thrived. High CO2 content has always been associated with a lush green world. And the opposite of a lush green world is a cold, dead world. So if I had to pick between one or the other, I would go, there's not too many girls in bikinis in a cold, dead world, so I would go with the lush green world.
I saw an illustration or a graph on NASA's website that showed the slight increase in CO2 over the last 50 or 60 years has generally increased Earth's green growth. Yet we still hear about how bad this is.
Yes, and what happens is the politicalization of science kind of distorts that germ. And so you look at organizations like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Well, they have a mission to stop CO2 emissions. And so they take the science and they do twist the message that all CO2 is bad. Now, one thing that I wrote about recently, and it seems to be doing well in collecting readership, is looking at the analogies people use for CO2 and how it causes global warming. And NASA is a bit schizophrenic because if you go on their website and NASA for Kids, and it'll show a greenhouse with a snowman on the outside and plants growing on the inside and say, this is the CO2 effect. And when you think of a greenhouse, and even little kids can think of a greenhouse, you walk inside and it's hot and it's humid and it's a bit uncomfortable. John Kerry, the climate change czar for the United States and former Secretary of State, he's gone on the air several times and said CO2 is like a thin blanket at the edge of the atmosphere that heats up the Earth. Well, that's simply not true. CO2 does not work like a greenhouse roof, and it is not a thin blanket of gases at the edge of the atmosphere. CO2 absorbs heat from the Earth at a certain radiation, and it re-emits it in all directions. And it's more like a recycler of heat, but it doesn't reflect heat back to the ground. It doesn't allow heat to build up like a greenhouse. It still allows most of the heat to radiate back to space. In fact, all the radiation, all the heat radiation that we receive every day from the sun, we lose that back to space every day. So CO2 is incapable of causing runaway global warming. And that's a message that the IPCC knows, but it doesn't get out. It likes the analogy of a CO2 greenhouse roof, and it wants people to assume that every CO2 molecule we put in the air is going to have the same warming effect, and it doesn't. And the analogy I use, Jerm, is the First Nations here in Canada, they used to fish with fish weirs, and the part of the country I live in is full of salmon, and the salmon swim from the ocean upriver to spawn. And if you would put a fish weir partway across a river, the first fisherman would catch a lot of fish. And then if you went upstream and wanted to catch more salmon, you would have to put in two more fish weirs to catch the same amount of fish as the first one did. And then if four more fishers came along and they built four more weirs even further upstream than the last two, it would take those four fish weirs to catch the same amount of salmon as the first fish weir. And so what is happening is you have to double the fish weirs every time to catch the same amount of fish. And that's called a logarithmic progression. And that's how CO2 works. So when you put a little bit of CO2 in the atmosphere where there is none, it's going to capture some heat and it's going to recycle that. And that's what keeps us warm. But then if you want to, if say all the CO2 we put in the air between the start of the Industrial Revolution, which is about 1850, 1875, to today, and let's say, let's round things off. Let's say that's caused 1 degree of global warming. Well, if you want to cause another 1 degree of global warming by CO2, you're going to have to put in twice as much CO2 as we did in the last 150 years. That's going to take a long time. Now, if you wanted to cause another 1 degree, so this would be the third 1 degree of global warming, you don't have to put in double the CO2 that we've already put in. You have to put in four times the CO2. So that's the logarithmic progression, and that comes from the Arrhenius theory, which the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change acknowledges and follows. Their press releases and their media content only concentrate on that first amount of CO2, what we've put in between 1850 and now. And they say, look how much global warming that has caused. And they would like you to believe that the next amount of global warming is going to be caused by the same amount of CO2. The next 1 degree will take the same amount of CO2. They're rather silent on that, but they would like you as a listener to jump to that conclusion. What they don't tell you is it's going to take twice as much and then twice as much again. So global warming by CO2 is a greatly diminishing effect. The other aspect to that is the entire 1 degree of global warming seen in the last century caused by mankind putting CO2 in the atmosphere? Well, the simple answer to that, it cannot be, because we were in 1850, we were at basically the coldest part of the last 10,000 years of human history. It was the coldest part of what we call the Little Ice Age. And you've probably seen the paintings of skaters on the River Thames. As a Canadian, those paintings are a little bit disturbing because it shows them playing hockey, and that's our game. What were they doing playing hockey in the 1850s? We weren't even around then. So, but that's apparently where it came from. And so in the last 150 years, the Earth must have warmed up naturally, because it wasn't until after World War II that we really started putting a lot of CO2 in the air. Yet 1950 was a lot warmer, about a degree warmer than 1850. So some of the global warming which we have experienced has been natural. And you can always look at ask yourself what caused that. And when you find these correlations, you have to check yourself and say, just because I correlated two events doesn't mean one caused the other. But what you should do is question it. As a scientist, you say there is some link there, and we should look into it. Well, the sun goes through cycles of how much energy it puts out. And I'll get back to that in a little bit. But during the Little Ice Age, we had five consecutive what are called grand solar minimums. And a solar minimum is a long period of time, say anywhere from 40 to 100 years, where sun activity is low. And you can observe that sun activity back then through telescopes by counting sunspots. And so the activity of the sun was low, and we had the coldest period of human knowledge in the last 10,000 years. And when we came out of that in 1875 to 1900, when things started warming up, we went into what's called a grand solar maximum. And that's when the sun activity is really high and you get lots of sunspots. And so if the sun activity is low and you have colder temperatures on Earth, and then the sun activity is high and you have warmer temperatures on Earth, you shouldn't ignore that and just say it's all CO2 coming from mankind. There's something natural going on there anyway. And the linkage really is with cloud cover. So when sun activity is low, the sun has a weak magnetic field. And that weak magnetic field lets cosmic rays from the galaxy, from imploding stars, exploding star supernovas in space, bombards the Earth with more cosmic rays. These cosmic rays can enable the formation of clouds on Earth. And those clouds on Earth, if they are low dense clouds, which cosmic rays can help develop, they reflect more sun back into space before it reaches the Earth. So low sun activity, more clouds, cooler Earth. That's sort of the link. The opposite of that is that when the sun activity is high, its magnetic field is stronger, and it shields us from more cosmic rays. Less cosmic rays hitting our atmosphere means less clouds. Less clouds means more sunlight hits the surface of the Earth and we get warmer. So that's something the IPCC and the mainline media don't even look at. But somehow between 1850 and 1950, things got warmer before we started putting CO2 in the air. So even the 1 degree or 1.3 degree, doesn't really matter what it is. That is not all caused by smokestacks of CO2 going into the atmosphere. A great deal of it has to be natural.
Okay, Ron, before we continue, I just quickly need to do an ad break. I'll be back with you shortly.
Okay. TNT Radio's Bruce DeTorres.
World peace and economic justice.
It's all the idea that they have the power they used to have, and that they can pick it up now with King Charles' coronation on May 6th,
right,
is actually what they hope everybody will think is happening, but it isn't happening.
Your assertion and conviction and certainty about that inspires me to no end, because anyone who studies reality as you and I do and I do could fairly conclude you can't fight City Hall. These are juggernauts of enslavement, digitally and otherwise. Set us straight about our hope and potential, Liz Dear.
My feeling about what's happening now is in the basic understanding that everything has a beginning, middle, and end. So for my purposes, I have described it as the end of the imperial stage of human existence. We have been there, done that, we got through it, and now we're ready to move on. And it's what's difficult, though, is that there's a lot of the old power structures still have a lot of power to keep the illusion going that they're still in control, but they're not.
Bruce DeTorres on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
This is a message for the parents of young children in the United States. I am Dr. Tess Lorry from the World Council for Health. Please consider the danger of vaccinating your children and babies with the COVID-19 injections. They are not the same as traditional vaccines and are causing significant harm to children around the world. Your children have their whole lives ahead of them. They are not endangered by COVID at all. Please hear us when we say, for your children, it is much safer to wait. Thank you.
So many people who had no history of heart illnesses have got it now, or blood clotting after the COVID-19 vaccination. Punish those who hurt people with COVID madness. Lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
Ron, how did CO2 become the bogeyman?
Oh, how did it become a bogeyman? I think when the greenhouse gas theory was introduced in the late 1900s, I think it was sort of interesting and put on the shelf. And at that time, it was going to be 500 years before we doubled the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere. And back then, the concentration was around 296 parts per million. Today, we're at 420. So we haven't quite doubled. We've gone up by about 50%. But I think the environmental movement always looks for They look for something they can latch onto as this is the enemy. This is the thing we have to stop. And before it was CO2, it was nuclear power. And so Greenpeace and organizations like that never talked about the benefits of nuclear power and how electricity was lifting billions of people out of poverty. They talked about nuclear power of how dangerous it could be if there was a runaway reaction, or how do we get rid of the nuclear waste, always looking at the negatives. And I think the oil and gas industry and the coal industry have always been in the sights of the environmental movement as we have to stop them. They're destroying the earth. Their footprint is too big. Whatever they're doing to the earth is bad for it. And so the thing that we can't stop in the oil and gas industry or the coal industry is emissions of CO2. You burn oil and gas, you burn coal, CO2 comes out. So I think it was an easy target, and that's why they used it. Second thing is that by not accurately describing how CO2 works, and by using the deceptively named greenhouse gas effect, it made people think of a greenhouse. And so now they have something that is very easily relatable to people and to fear. If you keep putting this in the air, we're all going to be living in a greenhouse, and that's going to be uncomfortable for everyone. And from that, they can just go with their hyperbolic explanations of melting ice caps and of boiling oceans and of mass extinctions and everything else. So CO2 is simply a very convenient and easy way to attack the hydrocarbon and fossil fuel industry, which is the target.
A greenhouse is a closed system, and I'm guessing Earth isn't. So is the greenhouse effect a real thing?
Yes, it is. Now, if you look at let's look at a greenhouse, okay? So the sun sends us shortwave radiation to the Earth, and about half of it does not make it to the surface of the Earth. About half of it gets bounced off of clouds and ice and the atmosphere and everything else. But the half that comes down to the Earth and heats up the oceans and the land, about 70% of that is converted into evaporating water and causing thermal currents, convection currents. So if you think of a thunder cloud forming, that's both heat of evaporation and that's thermal currents building. And so a greenhouse roof would trap that, and it just can't escape. But 30% of the sun's energy that warms up the earth escapes as radiation. And if you think of putting your hand over a toaster, or if you've seen waves come off of a hot asphalt, that's radiation. That radiation can make it through the clear glass of a greenhouse roof. But what I'm trying to point out here is that 70% of the energy that leaves the surface of the earth can be trapped by a greenhouse roof. 30% of it can't. Now, greenhouse gases do not stop the convection and they do not stop the evaporation. So right now, that 70% that the greenhouse roof captures is not captured by CO2. CO2 is one of five greenhouse gases, and it's responsible for about 25% of the, well, in a clear sky situation, it's responsible for about 25% of the greenhouse gas effect. But we don't live in a clear sky world. We live in a cloudy world. In a cloudy world, CO2 is only responsible between 2% and 4% of the greenhouse gas effect. The rest is all water vapor. And so we can't control how much water vapor is because we can't control the evaporation off the ocean. But what the CO2 molecule and what all greenhouse gas molecules do is they absorb this specific wavelengths of this heat, of radiation heat, long wave radiation. They absorb it and then they release it. And they release it in all directions. It's like hitting a xylophone bar with a mallet. So you have energy coming in from one direction, it hits the mallet, it radiates it like sound in all directions. Some of that goes up into space and it is lost. Some of it comes back down to Earth and gets reabsorbed. That amount that goes back to Earth and reabsorbed and goes back up to greenhouse gases, that is the greenhouse gas effect. and it's the recycling of energy from the greenhouse gases to the earth and back again. That's what keeps us warm. But it's not a closed loop, because those greenhouse gases radiate that energy in all directions. So it does escape. And so that's why it keeps taking twice as much CO2 every time to make the same greenhouse gas effect, the same 1 degree. But Jerm, where that breaks down is that pretty soon the temperature increase caused by CO2 is very small compared to many other factors that affect our climate. And one of those is that those convection currents I talked about. So when a CO2 molecule captures the specific wavelength of infrared radiation, before it releases it, it takes about a second to release it. Before it releases it, it could have up to 1 billion collisions with other air molecules like nitrogen and oxygen and everything else. And when two air molecules collide and they transfer energy from one to the other, that just warms up the other molecules and that causes more convection. So it's almost a self-correcting thing. As you add more CO2 and it captures more infrared radiation, it also has more collisions with other air atmospheres, causes more air circulation or more convection currents, and it brings it up to outer space. That's a plausible explanation of why we've had up to 12 times the CO2 in the air and we've never had runaway global warming, because pretty soon it gets to be such a small effect that other natural effects overtake it.
Right.
That makes sense?
Yeah, it absolutely does. If you'll just give me a moment, Murray is going to quickly do the headlines. I'll be back with you shortly.
Okay. Now, TNT Radio News.
Show them how it's done.
Let's go.
I got news for you.
News.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. Russia's top diplomat has praised Moscow's growing relationship with Africa as he embarks on a whirlwind tour of the continent. Facebook's parent company Meta has backflipped on its Donald Trump ban and has announced it'll now reinstate the former president's accounts. And the chief of the two Swiss-based companies that operate the Nord Stream gas pipelines in the Baltic Sea has come out and said Russia had nothing to do with last year's sabotage attack.
Silence for thinking differently? Not here. Silence for asking questions?
Not here.
Silence for discussing the other side of the story? Not on TNT Radio. Join the conversation anytime. Search TNT Radio on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Getter, or Gab. Download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk, TNT Radio.
Ron, the term climate change is constantly in the media. It's in the zeitgeist. It's probably the biggest narrative of our time. What is meant by the phrase climate change?
Well, Jeremy, I'll give you my interpretation. Climate change means global warming is no longer happening. And the reason I say that is because it didn't start as climate change. It started as global warming. And so as I mentioned before, the temperature, the thermometer records we have, which only go back to about 1850 and are really only based on European trade by ship back in 1850. So it's not nearly complete coverage of the world, but it's the best we have. And it shows a degree, 1.3 degrees warming since then. But we started getting satellite temperatures in 1979. And since then, in the past 40 years, global warming measured by satellite temperatures is only about 0.1 degree per 1 degree C per decade. So that's a degree a century, hardly anything. We can adapt to that. So satellite technology, which is a far superior technology for measuring the temperature on Earth, because it's not affected by the urban heat island effect. It's not affected by everyone having a different thermometer and correcting it for different reasons. It's almost 100% coverage of the Earth. So all of a sudden, when you start looking at satellite data, you say, well, this isn't a climate emergency anymore because global warming is arguably progressing as it did coming out of the Little Ice Age. So then how do you keep the narrative going that it's something to fear? Well, then it's climate change. If global warming stopped, then if you use climate change, you can start talking about, well, severe weather events. That's what we're afraid of. We're afraid of flooding. We're afraid of fires. We're afraid of droughts. And then there was a paper released. I'm struggling to remember the author's name, but it was extremely good. It was out of Italy. It was just last fall. And he looked all, this team of experts, statisticians, looked at all the data that was available and a lot of it that was used by the IPCC. And they say there is no discernible trends in hurricanes or in cyclones or in droughts or in fires or in all those disasters. They're about the same as far back as we can tell. The only real trend is that our technology allows us to survive them better and to adapt them better. So I think the terms actually went from global warming, and then that was no longer something to fear because it wasn't being experienced by people. Then it went to climate change because that kind of encompassed a number of things. And now I think there's an attempt to make the movement all about extreme weather. And extreme weather statistically isn't any worse than it ever was. We know about it more. I can talk to someone in South Africa and find out what the weather is, whereas 100 years ago, I would have no idea. But extreme weather isn't a problem.
Well, just so you know, today in Cape Town, at the bottom tip of the African continent, is obviously extreme weather. It is 30 degrees Celsius.
Horrible, horrible, yeah. So I do have a question for you, Jeremy. So you must have an older brother, I'm guessing.
No.
Okay. Well, I'm wrong. And I'm just saying, with a nickname like Germ, there's got to be an older brother somewhere that teased you as a kid. But
it was my schoolmates.
Oh, okay.
Good. But you get it though. It's the J. It's the play on the J.
Yeah.
But in any event, okay, so I want to ask you something quickly. This is very, very important. I think this is probably the most important question of the entire conversation. How do we stop cows from burping and farting? Because they are sending us to our doom.
Absolutely false. Okay. Well, I'm glad you asked that question. All right. So let's get back to that, how greenhouse gases work, okay? And that logarithmic regression that they have to double in order to have the same temperature increase each time. So CO2 is the big one that we can put in the air, and it would take, for us to double the amount of CO2 in the air, it would take about 240 years. And it is very true that methane, which cows put out, It is on an instantaneous basis, 80 times more powerful as a greenhouse gas than CO2. So that's the message the IPCC would like you to have. And you should think about a CO2 is 80 times, a cow has 80 times more power to increase greenhouse gases than a coal plant. But there's very, very little CO2 in the air. I think it's about 1.8 parts per million, and methane, 1.8 parts per million methane, where CO2 there's already 420. And we put out, for every CO2 molecule we put out, sorry, let me say that again, every methane molecule we put out 300 CO2 molecules. So the amount of CO2 compared to the amount of methane is very, very large. Methane is more powerful, but it would take about, I think, 180 years or more to double the amount of methane in the atmosphere and to get a 1 degree increase in global temperature from methane alone would take over 1,000 years. So it's like you're from a small country and you have a very powerful army, and your soldiers are feared because they're well-trained and they're dangerous. And they say, this is the army in the world we have to look out for. And the Chinese would say, no way, because they have an army of 5 million people. You know, it doesn't matter how powerful you are. CO2 so overwhelms both nitrogen and methane that nitrogen and methane are insignificant. They are insignificant, unmeasurable contributions to global warming. And I think this concentration on methane right now is you're asking, why do we call it climate change? Well, maybe that's one of the reasons. Because one thing that hasn't really caught in the press is that during the pandemic, NASA measured the amount of CO2 in the amount of CO2 emissions went up 5%, while most of the global economy was down something in the order of 10%. So we traveled less, airlines were shut down, emissions went down, yet the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere went up and total emissions went up. So either we don't know where all the emissions are coming from or someone's cheating on their emissions, but it looks like we are losing the battle to reduce CO2 emissions. Because if we shut down 10% of the global economy and emissions still going up, we're never going to win. We can't shut down the entire economy.
Could they argue that particular point and say, yes, but it's delayed?
If I was on their side, that's what I would say. It's delayed. The satellite temperatures aren't going up. They're pretty flat right now. And if you look at just the last 10 years, you would say there's no global warming. And the other thing you should look at is that the amount of CO2 that's coming out, particularly from Asia, I think in the last 10 years, I think we've put about 13% more CO2 in the air, and we've had no global warming. And that's since 1998. And so 1998 was an El Nino year, but we've put not just a little bit of extra CO2, we put 13% more CO2 in a period of time where there is no global warming. And 1998, that's 24 years ago. So there is an argument that the IPCC and the global warmingists say we're storing all that energy in the ocean and someday it's going to come out. I think that's because there's no other argument to make.
I'm going to ask you another question, but I think actually, Murray, let's just quickly do my last ad break and then I'm going to ask you, and I'll be back with you shortly.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Former President Donald Trump has already announced he's running for re-election in 2024. And a November poll done by Emerson College showed that Joe Biden would have beaten Trump back then 45-41%. But Emerson has done another poll and the results have changed. This poll was done since we all found out about Biden's document problem. Results released on Tuesday show Trump with a 3-point lead, 44-41%. That's a 7-point swing from last November's poll. And there's more from Emerson, this regarding the chances of Ron DeSantis. I find it hard to believe, but Trump holds a 26-point lead over DeSantis in a hypothetical Republican primary that is actually a 4-point drop from the November poll. Look, these numbers don't mean much at this point, but after all, the election is less than 22 months away. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Who is Klaus Schwab and what is the World Economic Forum which he leads? Klaus Schwab, the chairman of the World Economic Forum, believes transhumanization is a fundamental part of the Great Reset within the Fourth Industrial Revolution. He states, the difference of this Fourth Industrial Revolution is it doesn't change what you are doing. It changes you if you take genetic editing just as an example. It's you who are changed, and of course this has a big impact on your identity.
You're listening to Germ Warfare with Jeremy Nell on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
A few listeners are confused. My apologies. Ron Bombi is who I'm speaking to. You can find him on the CO2 Coalition's website. He's an engineer. and a whole bunch of other stuff. And when you hear the name Murray, Murray is the gentleman from Australia producing the show. He's the one who's keeping me on air. Okay, Ron, back to you. Okay, you were talking about cows a moment ago, and I was being facetious, but on a serious note, what is the significance of volcanoes?
Well, all the CO2 in the Earth, originally their primordial source was from volcanoes. So it spewed it into the atmosphere, you know, billions of years ago. So without volcanoes, there'd be no CO2, there'd be no life on Earth. The carbon cycle has taken that CO2 and turned it into rock, turned it into shells of organisms and everything else. That's another little point is, you know, there's things alive today that started forming, not alive today, their species started forming 300 million years ago when there's a lot of CO2 in the air, and they just drug it out of the air and they made shells out of it. And those things are still alive. So if you increase the CO2 a little bit now, that's how they evolved. But right now, the amount of CO2 that goes in the air, the organizations on the anthropogenic global warming side would say that was all put there by mankind. And other people would argue that can't be, that's about half of what's put in by mankind. Where's the rest coming from? Well, one source is the degassing of oceans. As the oceans warm up, they release oxygen and CO2 that's absorbed in there. Underneath the oceans, about 80% of volcanoes are subsea or sub-ice. So we don't know how often they erupt and how much CO2 they're putting out. And that may be somewhat of an explanation for the missing CO2 that's in our missing source of CO2 that's in our atmosphere. So we know the ones that are erupting on land, and we can get a good estimate of how much CO2 is coming out on that. But we have no idea, say in the Pacific Ring of Fire, how many volcanoes are burping up CO2 in the water, and then it just slowly gets to surface. We just don't know.
But the point is that volcanoes are actually quite significant, more so than cows.
Oh, more, yes. Probably much, much more so than cows. Yeah, it would take a lot. And the other thing, Jeremy, you have to think about cows, and this is particular to North America. Before we, in Canada, I think our herd of cows, both dairy and for beef, is something in the order of 3 million animals. And before Europeans showed up in Canada, there was probably something in the order of 10 to 25 million buffalo. We killed all the buffalo and we replaced them with cows. They have identical dietary yeah. tracts. And so yeah. why wasn't there a concern about the buffalo?
You know? I've got a photograph of Cape Town now and from 100 years ago, taken from pretty much the same location from the mountain that's in the center of the city. And it looks identical. There is absolutely no discernible difference in the height of the ocean.
Yeah. Yeah. And the problem with measuring the height of the ocean is that the land changes. And so if your reference point is sinking, it looks like the ocean's going up. Unfortunately, satellite data only goes back about 40 years, but satellite data tells us about a foot a century is what, and that is normal for coming out of the last glaciation. The other thing about the height of oceans is that all those little islands in the Indian Ocean that were supposed to be disappearing, recent studies out of Australia show that the coral reefs are healthy and they're growing and they're keeping up. And so if the ocean comes up an inch, the coral might come up an inch. You know, it seems to be, in my view, another overblown false catastrophe.
I saw something similar a number of years ago. You might have to correct me now because I'm going to possibly butcher this, but I remember some alarmism about the Great Barrier Reef, which was dying because of excess amounts of CO2 and all that, and apparently it's flourishing.
Yes, and that came out, again, I'm sorry, I can't remember the gentleman's name. It just came out around Christmas time, and he lost his job, I think,
Tim Ball.
Yes. Oh, no, there was another guy. Yeah. He was an Australian researcher, and the Great Barrier Reef has never been healthier since they started keeping records of it, and that was not covered well in the press. And these bleaching events turn out to be somewhat cyclical, and they may not be related to CO2 at all. The other thing you got to think about is all those hard-shelled marine animals like coral, they build from CO2. And so why would more CO2 kill them? You know, why would a mollusk that built its shell out of CO2 that evolved 500 million years ago, be bothered by more CO2? That's the environment that created it.
Speaking of bleaching events, you should have seen Murray a week ago. He spent too much time in the sun. Ron, as we're coming in. Go on.
Well, I said there's no problem in Canada right now. Of course, we're in our shortest days of the year, and it's quite cold. So, yeah, there's no sunburns happening right now.
As we come in for the last 8 minutes or so, how does one create a good analogy for global warming? I know that there was an article, a great article on your website, and you mentioned some bad analogies and better ones, and then you mentioned a great one from William Happer, who I've had on my show. Would you mind going through those analogies?
Well, the two bad one was the greenhouse roof, and that was John Kerry in NASA, and it falls down because the Earth is not a greenhouse and it doesn't have a roof. The second one was from Dr. Plimer, Australian, and from Dr. Coonan, an American. And they both used kind of a clear window scenario. And Dr. Plimer said, if you pull one blind across a window, you'll stop most of the light. The second one, you'll stop almost all the light. The third and the fourth are just ineffectual. And Dr. Coonan kind of said the same thing, only using black paint. The first coat is going to get almost all of it, the second coat, but if you keep painting it, it makes no difference. So what they're addressing is that there's only so much energy to block, and once you blocked it, adding more blockage doesn't help. Then the third analogy was my fish fear one, which I explained, and my analogy goes on to explain the math, that it's incremental reduction in global warming as CO2 goes up. And then Dr. Happer's analogy of the xylophone, I like it the best because it actually describes the capturing mechanism. And so the CO2 molecule can only be activated by a specific wavelength of infrared heat, and that's between 14 and 16 and a half microns. It would take five of those heat waves to be the thickness of one human hair. And so it kind of captures it like a spring, and then a second later releases it. And because that molecule is spinning in the atmosphere, is spinning in all directions, that infrared radiation is released in all directions, not just down to the Earth. Now, the other thing that hadn't mentioned, that Dr. Happer and it was Dr. Lindzen and Dr. Coonan pointed out, is that the CO2 in our atmosphere is a little bit unique from other gases. It's well mixed in the entire 80 kilometer thickness. And at some point, and they believe we're at that point right now, is that CO2 molecules from higher in the atmosphere, even if they release their radiation downwards, another CO2 molecule below it, which hasn't captured anything, will capture it, and then it'll send it right back up. And they're saying that right now, the only infrared radiation, the only heat that we get back from CO2 is only within a couple hundred meters of the surface of the Earth, because all the other CO2 acts as kind of a buffer preventing it from reaching the surface of the Earth. So that's another argument that CO2 in the atmosphere doesn't cause global warming above today's levels, because it gets mixed higher in the atmosphere and the heat just simply can't make it down to the surface of the Earth.
Just quickly, because I get asked this a lot, to ask guests like yourself, what impact does geoengineering have on the climate?
You could argue that the CO2 in the atmosphere, part of that is unintentional geoengineering, because we put it there. But when people start thinking they should put sulfur dioxide up in the atmosphere in order to reflect sunlight back to space, I would say no. First of all, you can't do something that affects everyone on Earth. And second, there's the law of unintended consequences. Putting sulfur dioxide up in the atmosphere is going to create acid rain. And if you remember from your history books, I think it was in the 1950s when London was hit by a terrible smog that I think killed 1,500 people and hospitalized 150,000 more. That was mostly because of sulfuric acid and rain mixing, and it came down too strong. So that was sulfur dioxide in the air from their smog, from burning coal in London, England. So I don't think we should take on geoengineering projects, because we don't have permission from the rest of the globe to do it, and because we don't understand it well enough to protect ourselves from unintended consequences. I think it's a bad idea, Jeremy.
Generally speaking, it's a very bad idea to play God.
Yes.
Mm.
Yes.
Oh, I would love to chat to you longer, and I think I'm going to have to invite you back, Ron. Although I must tell you, I feel sorry for you. It's some ungodly hour where you are right now, isn't it?
It is an ungodly hour. It's 4 o'clock in the morning here in British Columbia, but we're only getting 8 hours of daylight anyway. So get up in the dark anyway. If I could, Jerm, I'd like to tell tell your audience that my website is www.ronaldbarmby.ca. And the book I wrote is called Sunlight on Climate Change, A Heretic's Guide to Global Climate Hysteria. And what I do in that book is I try to explain the science of climate change in layman's terms. And so I read all the research papers from all of the classic physicists, and I try to put it in terms that everyone who's interested in it can understand it.
You beat me to it. I was going to ask you for that information. You jumped the
Sorry
gun.
About that, Jerm.
Look, yes, my last question. If you were to give just, I don't know, one paragraph summary of this entire conversation as a bite-size thought for those listening right now, what would it be?
The Earth is not a greenhouse, and CO2 is good for you.
It's simpler than that.
I tell you what, it's in the book, and it was Immanuel Kant, when the Age of Enlightenment was going on, he said, dare to know and have the courage to use your own understanding. So that would be my message to your listeners, is don't let the mass media or government organizations tell you what to think and what to do about climate change. Dare to know what it is yourself, figure it out, and have the courage to speak up and use your own understanding.
Ron Bomby, I wish there were more people like you. Thank you for joining me in the trenches.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Jerm.
I'm definitely going to invite you back. I hope you are willing to get up at an ungodly hour again.
I will.
And thank you to Murray for keeping me on the air today. So for those who often hear me talking about Murray, he's the other gentleman in the studio. He makes sure that that you can hear me. Send me an email, germwarfare@tntradio.live. Let me know where you are. If you enjoyed the conversation that I just had with Ron Bomby, let me know. It will be uploaded, I believe, tomorrow. So you'll be able to listen to it after the fact. And if you do want to listen to it, you'll need to download the app, the TNT app. It's in the Google and Apple store. As far as I know, the app hasn't been censored yet. We are all about free speech at TNT. And funnily enough, we haven't been censored. So that's a good start. okay. And I will catch you on Monday. I have no idea. I can't remember who I have lined up, but I will find out over the weekend. In the meantime, I'm out of here. I'm going to go enjoy my global warming here at the bottom tip of Africa. My name is Jerm. This is Jerm Warfare, the battle of ideas.